I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. In this episode, the last in our Composer Focus series from November 2018, Chief Conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Zachary Oromo, talks to Edward Seckerson about his countryman, Finnish composer Jean Sibelius.
Hello and welcome to this Barbican podcast with me, Edward Seckerson. My guest today is the Chief Conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Zachary Oromo. And he's here to talk about his countryman, Jean Sibelius. Zachary, one of the most enduring mysteries of music is how profoundly it connects with its nationalistic roots, the landscape and ethos of the country where it was created. And as a fellow Finn, I just wondered what it was about Sibelius that speaks of your homeland.
Yeah, that's always a good question, and also a kind of... It's a question that has many sides to it, but I would compare Sibelius's relationship with Finland and Finnish culture about to Janacek's relationship to his own Czech culture. So they both drew inspiration from the folk art of their respective nations. They both, I think, were influenced by the language, which means the music they wrote was influenced by the language. However, Sibelius was different to Janáček in one respect. He never ever used a single folk tune as such in his music. Never. There is a set of transcriptions for solo piano of folk songs, but even those seem to be written by Sibelius himself. So those folk songs don't have any corresponding pieces in the sort of folk tradition. And in Sibelius' case... He was, of course, the one who brought Finland onto the world map culturally. But he couldn't do it if he hadn't sort of immersed himself in the Germanic symphonic tradition by studying in Vienna and in Berlin, by coming quite early on under the influence of people like Brahms, Bruckner, and of course his teachers, whose names have been sadly more forgotten. Yes, Sibelius, of course, means everything to Finland in terms of musical existence. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he's not solely and singularly a Finnish phenomenon. He didn't speak Finnish as his native language. He was a Swedish speaker who learned Finnish only when he got to know his future wife, Aino, who was from a very Fennophile, talking about language, Fennophile family, the Järnefelt family. And of course, Sibelius had sort of gotten this great revelation of what folk music can really bring by listening to the rune singer Larin Paraske, who was a very famous already elderly lady who sort of recited these hours and hours long old Karelian, you would call them chants or runes, which apparently made a really huge impression on Sibelius when he was able to hear them live.
Do you think, I mean, he's often credited as having helped Finland develop its national identity during the struggle for independence from Russia. Do you think there's much truth in that? Or, I mean, pieces like Finlandia and the Second Symphony often has that layer of meaning imposed upon it, which perhaps isn't there. I wonder what your view on that was.
Well, my view is early on in his career, he was very much a part of this movement. To sort of reinforce the identity of Finland to get rid of the Russian Empire as a ruler. And he was a part of a group of artists, but none other were composers. There were writers and painters and such like, who all had the same kind of basic foundation to their art. And I think early on Sibelius was very much a political composer. I mean, he wrote pieces like the Karelia Suite, the music to the Karelia play. He wrote the Jägermarsch a little bit later, for which he was almost got rid of his life during the Civil War of 1918. He wrote several pieces that directly took a stance on political things. On the other hand, he was always striving to become an absolute composer, a composer of music without external meanings. And I think the Second Symphony is kind of... Of course, many etiquettes can be easily... many labels can be attached to it. Mm. But it is essentially a piece which is striving for the independence of the musical material, yeah. And not any extra musical sure. effects.
In that, his love of nature... And I talked about national identity. His love of nature was well known. And that is so clear in the landscape of the music, particularly a piece like Tapiola, which is just almost graphic in its depiction of that kind of wild, windswept landscape. In that, I suppose, he had something in common, perhaps the only thing in common, with Gustav Mahler, who was a pantheist at heart as well, and a nature lover. But how important is that love of nature in the music?
It is very important. It's all-encompassing, I think. Mm. And he had musical associations with phenomena of nature, like he wrote in his diary... whilst working on the Fifth Symphony, which was at that time a hybrid between the Fifth and Sixth, he wrote swans migrating, black earth, lots of sordinos, for instance. And that is audible, I think, in the final movement of the Fifth Symphony very much, which really digs deep below the surface.
Well, there are all those wonderful bass pedals in his music, you know, which are almost unfathomable. You know, they're sunk so deep.
They are roots.
Yes.
Like trees have roots. And the root systems can be hugely bigger than the tree itself. On the other hand, in the German cultural environment, mostly, Sibelius is often described as a landscape painter, and that's, I think, what he wasn't. Mm-hmm. His relation to nature in terms of music, I think, is more akin to Beethoven's. in the Pastoral Symphony, for instance, than to say Mahler's, because Mahler's pantheism was on such a level that he actually, encompassed everything.
Yes.
In his music. Whereas with Sibelius, it's more like a sort of external viewpoint, observing. There is often a subject observing things happening in nature, and only in Tapiola, and I think partly in the music to The Tempest, so his very last works, there is no person anymore. Mm. It's only the nature, and I think that's the way he was sort of heading to throughout his music.
You've talked about Finnish folklore and mythology, and great source of inspiration for him, the Kalevala. Piece I adore is Luonnontar, for soprano and orchestra. It's a sensationally original piece, I think.
Yeah, for its shortness.
Yeah.
It only lasts, 10, 11 minutes performed. Mm. It has the makings of a really big symphonic work. And he called it a symphonic poem for soprano orchestra. And Luonnontar is, of course, inspired by one of the myths in Kalevala, the creation myth, which has a lot to do with the biblical creation myth, but it has some elements which are kind of wonderfully naive and incredibly sort of descriptive at the same time. Luonnontar, in a way, is a key piece in Sibelius' production because he wrote it between the third and fourth symphony, when he was sort of getting away from this junge Klassizismus, the sort of young classical style, which he very much tried out in the third symphony, also in the violin concerto, partly. And he was heading towards this more abstract, more mythical, mysterious, introvert style. And Luonnontar is kind of the missing link, in a way, between these very different worlds.
The core of his output, though, of course, we've talked about them in passing, are the seven symphonies. And each says something different about him, the journey he's taking. Which are the most important from your point of view? Which do you feel closest to, in a way? I mean, it's an impossible question because they're each individual and amazing in their different ways.
Yeah, I think Sibelius invented a new technique of composition for each of his symphonies. And everything else he wrote, maybe except the string quartet Voces Intime and some of the tone poems, he himself considered as sort of second rate, or like music he wrote for a living, for getting the money instantly from the publishers and all that. And of course, he was cut away by the First World War as well, very much, because he lost contact with his German publisher, which was on the opposite side, so he suffered a lot. I can't really single any of them out, actually. They're all kind of so different, and what I find so interesting is that there are seeds of the coming symphonies in each of them. Even in Kullervo, which is before the First Symphony, you can find seeds to the Fifth Symphony.
He's laying out his stall, if you like.
And then he's gradually, throughout the symphonies, reducing his kind of equipment and stall and making more economical use of the elements that he finds most productive for his music at that moment. And for instance, the Fourth Symphony, which starts with this incredible tritone gesture, there's a very strong tritone passage in the Third Symphony, and so on. It kind of goes on all the time. So you find sort of elements that then come into full flourishment in the following symphony.
You mentioned the Fourth. It sits between I love the Third Symphony, but that kind of rhythmic impulsiveness, but it's very tight as a piece. And the Sixth is very refined as a piece. And then you've got this dark and extraordinary world between them, with a slow movement that I think, I mean, we've talked, mentioned Mahler, but if there is any comparison to be made, that one hears, I think, some Mahler in that slow movement. I don't know, it's just an illusion maybe or something.
I don't actually get that impression at all.
You don't?
From my point of view, no. I think that Il Tempo Largo, third movement of the Fourth Symphony, it has kind of, for me, it has all the elements that Mahler doesn't, and vice versa. It doesn't use the elements that Mahler uses in his slow movements, some of which are really gorgeous, like the one in the Fourth Symphony, for instance, of Mahler. Mm. But Sibelius tries to do something completely different. He sort of forms these perfect little cells of music and then expands them to something massive. And it can be compared only to how a tree grows out of a small seed or a little, small thing becomes, elaborates itself and grows into this really strong structure. But the innate fragility of the Fourth Symphony of Sibelius is always there. I mean, it feels as though the structure is, it's so well rooted, and yet if you push it along just a little bit, it feels like it's almost falling apart. It's very fragile, and at the same time, very, very strong.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So you think there is much more of a connection between 3, 4 and 6 than...
Yeah, and even 5, actually, for me. Yes, there is a strong connection. And when people first heard Sibelius' Fourth Symphony, when it was premiered in Helsinki, he reported that there were kind of strange looks. No one dared say anything. There was a sort of consummate applause, but not very enthusiastic. People didn't really know what to make of it. And having that experience and then going on to write something that then became the Fifth Symphony is, of course, very understandable, because that gives a sort of an occasion for a huge, rapturous response. Mm-hmm. But the Fourth really is an enigma.
Oh, and right from the first note.
Yes.
It plunges you into this... And there are always those moments in his music where it's almost as though he's suddenly lost in time and space, and you don't know where it's going to go. There might be some very distilled moment with just a bassoon solo, or
yes, indeed, yeah, very bare barren landscapes where nothing seems to be moving. There's just a lonely crow somewhere, maybe making its way through the dead leaves, whatever. These associations can be endless.
Yeah.
But as an interpreter, I can't stress enough how many problems the Fourth Symphony poses on the conductor, on the interpreter of the music. There are dozens of recordings which have very willful solutions, but many of them don't really capture anything of the essence of the piece. And Sibelius wasn't perhaps the most precise score writer. I mean, he did leave some freedom to interpret what he meant. But I think still the basic musical elements are very much there. And for instance, the tradition of slowing down the tempo very much at the end of the finale of the Fourth Symphony, I think, takes away the whole point, which is kind of this running out of energy and just stopping without making a big point of it.
Maybe it was Karajan's fault that made me hear Mahler.
Yeah, I'm sure, yes. Karajan, Bernstein, yes.
The last symphony redefines the word organic, the Seventh Symphony. And of course it ends with this equivocal, the most equivocal C major in all music. It just kind of, clings on by its fingernails.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, extraordinarily original, but as you say, they all are in their different ways. Finally, Sakari, two of his most popular works, the Violin Concerto and the Fifth Symphony, exist in two versions. Now, this is fascinating when you hear the originals, because in some ways they're more radical and more fascinating, but they ain't as good, if you like. What is your take on that? Does that make sense, that kind of theory? Because sometimes composers' first thoughts they play with them and then somehow all that kind of edge and originality disappears and it becomes more perfect. Mm. What is your take on that?
Yeah, things? I agree on that. And it's incredibly interesting to listen to the early versions. In terms of the Violin Concerto, the early version is much more difficult to play. It's much more virtuosic, although even the final version is difficult enough. But the first version is—it's not unplayable, but it's very, very, very demanding, and it's about 10 minutes longer than the final version. It has two extra cadenzas, for instance, quite big cadenzas. And I think what Sibelius wanted to really do is to ensure its performability, and to streamline the form of the piece, which he found maybe to be a little too sprawling. So he took out all these interesting cadenzas that sound almost like a Bach solo sonata gone mad, or Isaïe, or something, virtuoso music for violin. And he gained, of course, in the sort of perfectness of form. But it's so fascinating to hear the early version. Whereas in the Fifth Symphony, I think there is only a really big gain in having the final version. Mm-hmm. Just because he invented this wonderful way of bridging the material of the first movement and the scherzo to become one movement, which I think is a key moment in the piece and maybe in all of Sibelius's production. He finds a common denominator between musical materials that are almost opposite to each other.
It's still a wonderful insight into how the mind was working.
Yes.
And it was such an unpredictable mind as well in many ways.
It was. And the first version of the Fifth Symphony, it seems that all the endings are very abrupt. And that's where he kind of takes over from the ending of the Fourth Symphony and makes these kind of clear-cut things that feel to us like they don't really lead anywhere. They just finish. I guess it's a very Finnish thing to do as well. But
is it? Because yeah, I find that fascinating, those moments. The end of the second movement is sort of the third symphony, the middle movement,
yes.
where it just sort of, I finish, so I'm going to stop.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah, it's true. It's almost like recitative chords, like after having this musical discourse, you just put down the chords and it's finished. It's finito. And in those terms, yes, I think that there is a kinship there to the original version of the fifth. But the eloquence and the sort of great vistas of the final version are still, I think, incomparable.
But where does he stand in the great plan of music, do you think, and why?
Well, if you look at it from the sort of Central European perspective, which Sibelius very much wanted to belong to, he is one of those very significant later Romantic era composers that had their roots in their native cultures, but that took a lot of influence from the Central European symphonic idea. I could name people like Elgar, certainly, Janáček, certainly, Enescu in Romania, Szymanowski, Sibelius, for instance, who were kind of these people who believed in symphony and in the symphony as a form and kind of wanted to elaborate its appearance, make it freer, but at the same time keep the cohesion and very much cling on to their musical roots.
Thanks to Zachary Oromo and Edward Seckerson, and to you for listening to this archive series of Composer Focus. This is the final episode in the series, but stay subscribed to Nothing Concrete to hear more episodes from our archive and new podcasts from the Barbican. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts. And, if possible, leave us a review so we can help more people discover and explore the wonder that is the arts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.